Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Kelly Jean Kelly, John Russell, and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Many Syrian refugees in Turkey want to stay in the country, although Turkey plans to send them back home. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said the government plans to send up to 2 million refugees back to Syria. Human rights groups have warned of possible expulsions of refugees. Many of the refugees have started new lives in Turkey and see no reason to return to Syria. Syrian refugee Issam Abdi owns Mandi, a restaurant in Istanbul. It has been serving people in the Turkish city for more than 6 years. "We will not return to Syria," Abdi told VOA. Abdi left Syria at the start of the civil war. He arrived in Istanbul speaking very little Turkish and having no contacts. But he was still able to build a successful business. He now owns 2 restaurants. His children attend college, and he sees Turkey as the only country offering his family a better future. "Because of the war, it's not safe there," Abdi said of his Syrian homeland. "They say in Damascus it is safe, but there is no electric, no gas, no nothing. It is easier to live here." While Istanbul has been good for Abdi and his family, he admits that other Syrians have had a more difficult time. "They can't find a job. They are in debt," he said. "There are some people who want to go back." Turkey has accepted more than 3.5 million Syrian refugees who fled the war. The refugees are expected to return to what Turkey considers a safe area in Syria. The area was taken by Turkish forces in an operation against a Kurdish militia. But experts have warned that the Turkish government's plan faces major opposition from diplomats and many refugees themselves. Soli Ozel is an international relations instructor at Istanbul's Kadir Has University. "I don't see any reason why Syrian President Bashar al-Assad will want any of those refugees back," Ozel said. "And he certainly will not take most of them back. I just don't see it." Last month, an Amnesty International report accused Turkey of forcing refugees back to Syria this year. "It is likely that hundreds of people across Turkey were swept up, detained, and transported against their will to one of the world's most dangerous countries," the report said. The U.S.-based Human Rights Watch also accused the Turkish government of such actions. Its report said detentions and forced returns took place in January and September. Turkey's foreign ministry denied the accusations. The claims in the report about Syrians being forcibly sent back, threatened, and mistreated are false and imaginary, a ministry spokesman said. Turkish officials have said all Syrian refugee returns will be voluntary and observe all international laws. The government says more than 350,000 Syrian refugees have already voluntarily returned to their country. I'm Brian Lynn.
A new show in the American state of New Mexico is reminding visitors of the world George Orwell imagined in his book 1984. Orwell wrote it in 1949 to warn people of their possible future. In this story, the government controls the population with propaganda. Every message from the extremely repressive leadership reverses the truth. Officials repeat, war is peace, and freedom is slavery, for example. The Ministry of Truth spreads lies. The Ministry of Love tortures lovers. Orwell was British, but the book has been popular with readers around the world for many years. The current show in New Mexico is called George Orwell, His Enduring Legacy. It includes posters and other pieces related to 1984. It also has objects related to another of his famous books, Animal Farm. The show will be at the University of New Mexico's Zimmerman Library in Albuquerque until April. It was launched after a professor at the school donated his collection of rare Orwell books. They include first editions of Animal Farm and Animal Farm in Icelandic, Ukrainian, Swahili, French, Urdu, German, Hungarian, and Spanish. The books in different languages show how many people Orwell reached. Readers throughout the years have argued that Orwell remains relevant in their time. They say real news stories show how people use what Orwell called doublespeak, words that are supposed to be unclear, or thought crimes, ideas that government officials or crowds of people say should not be permitted. In the U.S. today, some of President Donald Trump's language has been called Orwellian. For example, after Turkey attacked Kurdish population centers in the country, Trump said, "The Kurds are much safer right now." During Trump's time in office, the book 1984 has become a bestseller in the U.S. again. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Imagine you want to improve your writing skills. Perhaps you would like to take an English test or use English in a business email. Today on Everyday Grammar, we will talk about something that could help you, appositives. We will explain the grammar rules behind appositives and demonstrate how to use them in sentences. Let us begin with a few definitions.
An appositive is a word or group of words that renames something else. An appositive is often a noun or noun phrase that helps explain or identify another noun or a pronoun. Take this sentence, for example.
My best friend, Ahmed studies English literature.
The subject of the sentence is my best friend. The name Ahmed is an appositive. It adds information to the sentence. What is important is that the sentence is grammatically correct without the appositive. So, our example without the appositive would read,
my best friend studies English literature.
Now, let us consider a more complex example. Imagine you are reading a crime novel. Perhaps the book has the following lines.
Police questioned the next suspect, the victim's ex-wife.
In this example, the victim's ex-wife is the appositive. The words give readers more information about the next suspect. If the sentence did not have an appositive, it would have been written this way. Police questioned the next suspect.
Martha Kolln and Robert Funk wrote a famous book on English grammar. In it, they note that if an appositive renames the subject of a sentence, it can introduce the same sentence. Kolln and Funk say the following description, by Michael D. Lemonic and Andrea Dorfman, is a good example of an introductory series of appositives. It is about epithets, or insulting terms, that people used to describe the Vikings of Northern Europe.
Ravagers, despoilers, pagans, heathens, such epithets pretty well summed up the Vikings for those who lived in the British Isles during medieval times.
The nouns ravagers, despoilers, pagans, and heathens are all epithets, the subject of the sentence. The writers could have left out the list of nouns. Instead, they could have begun the sentence simply with the words epithets such as or such epithets. You might be asking yourself why this discussion is important. The reason is this. Using appositives correctly is one of the best ways to improve your writing style. Appositives can help writers change the rhythm or order of a sentence. In other words, appositives help make sentences more interesting. Think back to our first example.
My best friend Ahmed studies English literature.
If you were to write the example as two separate sentences, it might be something like this.
My best friend studies English literature. My friend's name is Ahmed.
These sentences are grammatically correct, but they are repetitive. In other words, they are less interesting to read.
The next time you are reading, try to find examples of appositives. Ask yourself why the writer might have chosen to use them. When you practice writing in English, perhaps for a test or business purposes, try to use appositives in certain places. They will help make your writing smooth and clear if you use them correctly. We will leave you with a famous example. In his book, A History of the English-Speaking Peoples, Winston Churchill wrote the following words about Britain's Queen Victoria.
High devotion to her royal task, domestic virtues, evident sincerity of nature, a piercing and sometime disconcerting truthfulness, all these qualities of the Queen's had long impressed themselves upon the mind of her subjects.
Can you identify the appositive? Can you identify the subject of the sentence? Write to us in the comments section of our website. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In the middle of the 1850s, the United States was again struggling with the issue of slavery. The dispute centered increasingly on Kansas, a territory in the middle of the country. In Kansas, white men were able to vote on whether they wanted slavery to be legal in the territory. Many Kansas settlers opposed slavery. Some of the settlers were Northern abolitionists. They believed that owning another person was immoral. Many farmers also opposed legalizing slavery. They did not want to compete with slave labor. But many people in the nearby state of Missouri wanted Kansas to permit slavery. Slavery was legal in Missouri, and many Missouri slave owners wanted to live next to a territory where slavery was legal. So when Kansas held elections, pro-slavery men from Missouri crossed the border and voted illegally. Yet their votes were accepted.
The result of the territorial elections is that you have a territorial legislature that is overwhelmingly pro-slavery. It will write a slave code for Kansas. It will say Kansas is a slave territory. Slavery is protected here.
Nicole Etchison is a historian. She says the newly elected Kansas legislature created strong laws to protect slavery in the territory. The laws said no Kansan could speak or write against slavery. And they said people who tried to help slaves escape could be put in jail or executed. The lawmakers also demanded that President Franklin Pierce dismiss the territory's governor, who opposed slavery. The president agreed. He appointed a pro-slavery governor instead. Anti-slavery settlers in Kansas grew angry. They felt they could not get fair treatment from the president or the new governor. They said pro-slavery groups cheated to control the elections. So the anti-slavery settlers took an extreme step. They formed their own government. Their political group was known as the Free State Party. Its members wrote their own constitution. They also chose their own governor. Historian Nicole Etchison says Free State members refused to recognize the bogus authority of the official Kansas legislature.
That is the argument that the Free State political movement will make. Not so much that slavery is an awful thing, although some of them make that argument, but that free white settlers in Kansas have had their political rights at the ballot box denied.
President Pierce said the actions of the Free State Party seemed revolutionary. He said that if party members attacked any government property or official, party leaders should be charged with treason. Pierce gave the pro-slavery governor of Kansas control of troops at two army bases in the territory. The situation threatened to turn violent at any time. In November 1855, a pro-slavery man killed a free state man in a dispute over land claims. To answer the attack, free state settlers threatened the killer and burned his house. At the same time, hundreds of pro-slavery men crossed the border from Missouri. They planned to burn the town of Lawrence, where many free state members lived. The pro-slavery governor and the free state governor agreed to hold an emergency meeting. They negotiated a settlement, and the men from Missouri went home. But the truce did not last long. In the weeks that followed, a pro-slavery sheriff attempted to arrest the leaders of the free state government, but failed. A few days later, the law enforcement official was shot. Around the same time, a pro-slavery grand jury found several free state leaders guilty of treason. The grand jury also said the town of Lawrence was supporting illegal newspapers and a hotel that stored weapons. Pro-slavery officials moved to take control of the town. The wounded sheriff urged private citizens to help. Once again, hundreds of men, including many from Missouri, gathered in Kansas. Once again, the target was Lawrence. This time, however, there was no truce. On May 21st, 1856, a group of pro-slavery men marched into the town. Historian David Potter describes the incident in his book, The Impending Crisis. He says the mob entered Lawrence with flags and flying banners as if it were a victorious army. Some men threw two newspaper printing presses into the river. Others freed as much alcohol as they could find. And Potter writes, the group turned five cannons on the Free State Hotel. The mob fired the cannons at the hotel and burned the house where the Free State governor lived. But no anti-slavery settlers were killed. The only person killed was a pro-slavery man. He died when part of the Free State Hotel fell on him. Anti-slavery newspapers called the attack the Sack of Lawrence. In other words, they suggested that pro-slavery raiders had completely destroyed the town. A settler named John Brown heard about the attack on Lawrence. Brown was from the eastern state of Connecticut, but he had recently moved to Kansas. He strongly opposed slavery. He also thought the free state government was too weak. So John Brown persuaded four of his sons, his son-in-law, and two other men to answer the sack of Lawrence. Brown believed that the battle against the forces of slavery must continue, and he believed that God had chosen him to lead it. Late at night, Brown and the other men went to a settlement near Pottawatomie Creek. They went to three homes and seized five pro-slavery men.
Took these men out of their beds, defenseless, unarmed, and hacked them to death with broadswords.
Historian Nicole Etchison explains that Brown's group seized the men, murdered them, and left their bodies next to the creek. The event became known as the Pottawatomie Massacre. The combination of the sack of Lawrence and the Pottawatomie Massacre frightened both pro- and anti-slavery forces. Both sides believed they could be attacked at any time. They began collecting weapons to defend themselves. In the summer and autumn of 1856, the competing forces repeatedly threatened each other. They forced each other off land. They burned each other's houses. More people were killed. The territory became known as Bleeding Kansas. Nicole Etchison says the term Bleeding Kansas was evocative. In other words, it made people feel strongly.
The term is so evocative because it's a propaganda term.
Ms. Etchison says that many people, especially in the North, were against slavery in the territory. These individuals used the term Bleeding Kansas in their newspapers to gain support for their cause. The Kansas-Nebraska Act and the violence that followed also gave birth to a new political party. Its members called themselves Republicans. The Republican Party was an unusual combination of groups. It included former Democrats who were angry that their party had supported the Kansas-Nebraska Act. They believed the Democrats were allowing slavery to expand. The Republicans also included members of the old Whig Party. The Whig Party had lost badly in the elections of 1852 because its members could not agree on whether slavery should be legal. Anti-slavery Whigs found a new home in the Republican Party. The Republican Party of the 1850s also included voters who did not support immigrants, especially Irish Catholics. These nativist Republicans wanted to protect the rights of American Protestants. All Republicans were united, however, in their opposition to slavery in the Kansas and Nebraska territories. Some Republicans were abolitionists. They wanted to ban slavery everywhere in the United States. But the majority of Republicans had no interest in ending slave labor in the South. They simply did not want slavery to spread to other areas. Nicole Etchison says that white Southerners did not respond well to the new party. They believed that all Republicans were like John Brown, the anti-slavery settler who had murdered five pro-slavery men.
White Southerners do not see the distinction between a Republican Party that says, we don't like slavery, it's immoral, it shouldn't expand, and a John Brown who says, I don't like slavery, it's immoral, and it ought to be overturned by violence.
In 1854, some Republicans from the state of Illinois asked a politician named Abraham Lincoln to serve on their committee. Lincoln refused. He did not like slavery, but he still supported the Whig Party. 2 years later, in 1856, the Republicans nominated a presidential candidate for the first time. He was John C. Fremont. Fremont had explored the American West. He had been a senator from California. He was young and exciting. Republicans thought he was the right man to lead their young and exciting party. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.